Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Led Zeppelin's When Levees Break to recognize the fourth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. On his weekly radio address, President Obama pledged to work to advance the recovery effort along the Gulf Coast and announced he'd visit New Orleans before the end of the year. Obama reminded us that over 1,000 people lost their lives, over 1 million were displaced, and whole neighborhoods were left in ruins. He said his government had put in place dispute settlement programs in an effort to speed up the recovery, and he said the government has freed up hundreds of millions of dollars in assistance that has not been distributed. Nearly 4 years after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita pounded the Louisiana and Mississippi coasts, watery reminders of those 2005 storms still lurk in lakes, marshes, and bayous across the states. Sunken sailboats still sit in the canals. Major log jams clog rivers with some of the more dangerous obstructions beneath the surface, posing an unseen hazard to boaters and shrimpers. FEMA and the Coast Guard have pledged to pick up the debris, with officials spending more than 8 months last year observing and recording more than 6,000 separate debris locations across nearly 800 miles of Louisiana waterways. The Coast Guard estimated that cleanup contracts stretching from Cameron Parish to the Mississippi border would be completed by this fall, but so far only eastern stretches of Lake Pontchartrain and some rivers along the North Shore have been addressed. Contracts to clean up marine debris in the rest of the state of Louisiana have yet to begin, although the Coast Guard expects that several of the removal contracts will begin within a month. FEMA so far has allocated about $20 million for surveys and debris removal and has already paid $170 million for emergency work done immediately after the 2005 storms. This week marks the fourth mass trial of opposition supporters in Tehran on charges of rioting and plotting to topple the ruling Islamic system following the disputed presidential election of June 11th. At the same time, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini appears to have undercut Ahmadinejad's attempt to convict dozens of former government officials, journalists, and academics of collaborating with the West, saying that a connection had not yet been proved. Meanwhile, Mir Hossein Mousavi, the defeated candidate in the controversial elections, announced the formation of a grassroots social movement called the Green Path of Hope. That is, according to a senior Mousavi aide, a continuation of the Green Movement aimed at regaining people's denied rights. Mousavi is branding the organization a social movement because establishing a political party in Iran requires the permission of the Ministry of Interior, and there are strict regulations for political parties which are impossible for Mousavi to obtain while the ministry is under Ahmadinejad's control. Setting up a so-called social movement is not yet regulated, and there are, as yet, no regulations to control such a movement. With me today to give a contemporary historical context to current events in Iran is Jafar Yoqubi, born in Tabriz, Iran, where he finished his Bachelor of Science degree in 1971. After receiving his PhD in genetics from UC Davis in California, Jafar Yoqubi and his wife returned to Iran shortly after the victory of the Revolution of 1979 with the hope of being part of the great historic moment and to help their country. Jafar taught at the National University of Iran and later worked in the Ministry of Agriculture in Tehran. The couple soon realized that the mullahs already had hijacked the revolution and the country, and Jafar joined an opposition leftist group to fight the new theocratic authoritarian regime and to struggle for freedom, justice, and the democratic rights of the people. I'd like to welcome Jafar Yakubi to our show today. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we turn to what is happening in Iran today, Jafar, tell our listeners a little about your experiences in Iran at the time that you were there after 1979.
Well, I should start by saying that immediately after the revolution of 1979 and taking power by Ayatollah Khomeini, after he returned to Iran, he basically lost the trust of the opposition by curtailing most of the rights that opposition were promised to have in Iran. And very soon, even after like half a year after the revolution, thugs and Islamic militia attacked any gathering of the opposition in Iran. And any publication center, any group was attacked. Many were arrested within a year or so. Although there was a relative freedom in Iran after the revolution for a year or so, but that came to an end in June 1981 when there were clashes in Iran between the group, leftist radical group called Mujahideen-e-Khalq, People's Mujahideen, which was an Islamic leftist radical group, and Ayatollah Khomeini supporters. These clashes changed everything within the society, and following that, which resulted in massive arrests and torture and killing of thousands of people in Tehran and other city prisons, everything changed in Iranian prisons as well. It was in this atmosphere, after I had returned to Iran and I had started activity with a leftist group called People's Fedaiyan of Iran, that I was arrested in 1984. Well, after I was arrested in the street, actually I was basically kidnapped in the street and was taken to a detention center called the Comité. I was tortured, I was interrogated. The tortures were both physical and psychological in those days. And then I was interrogated, all blindfolded. And I was kept in solitary for 7-8 months in the Comité. Afterwards, I was sent to the infamous Evin prison. And I was kept there for another few months, where I was sent to an Islamic tribunal. And I was given a 15-year sentence. After that, I was sent to another prison, Ghazal Hisar prison, which I spent another year in that prison. Finally, I ended up in the Gohardasht prison, which I was kept for two and a half more years. It was in the Gohardasht prison in 1988 that with a fatwa, a religious edict from Ayatollah Khomeini, thousands of prisoners who had already been convicted and already had sentences and were serving their sentences were brutally killed, and most of them were hanged in prisons in Iran. I survived that mass killing of prisoners in the summer of 1988, and then I was released along with hundreds of prisoners in 1989.
And at the time, did the public know what was going on in the prisons? Was there a sense of people understanding?
Well, we have to understand that early after the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini and his regime had a massive following in Iran. Maybe 70-80% of the Iranians really supported and were hoping that things will get better, so they supported Khomeini and his regime. And because of that, and because of the absolute control of the media and the newspapers, and the defeat of the opposition, there was really no other voice in the country. So people, either they did not hear in news of the prisons, or the devout followers of the Khomeini really ignored what they heard, or they did not believe if they heard that there was torture and killing in prison. So, and the regime, even up, even to, until today, the regime has not accepted that in the summer of 1988, they killed maybe 3,000-4,000 prisoners. They hanged 4,000 prisoners in the prisons in Iran by Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa. Mm. So officially, they do not accept it. They do not admit to it. And that's why it's important, and I emphasize my goal of the memoir I'm writing, which we hopefully will be published soon, is to expose the idea that they have killed 4,000 prisoners in the summer of 88 and still will not admit officially that this happened, this event happened in Iran.
Now, Jafar, your wife was in Iran at the time, too, and you at that point had a little daughter. How did she find out that you had been arrested?
Well, as I said, I got arrested in a street in Tehran. So when I had not returned at that night, my wife had figured out that probably I had been arrested. And my daughter was only 1.5 years old then. So my wife had struggled to be able to get a chance to find me, first of all, because they did not even know where I was for months. But after a few months, after she had figured out through official channels that I had been arrested, then there was no point for her to really, and they had not given her any right to visit me. So she was safer to leave Iran, and I had agreed with that, indirectly. So she took our daughter, and they left Iran, actually, after 5-6 months after my arrest.
Uh-huh.
And because she was a U.S. citizen, she came back to America and then ended up later in Europe, in Germany, and lived there with my daughter until I was released and escaped to, I came to Germany.
And what? Why did they release you? What was the reason they were...
Well, that was another unique feature of the Islamic regime in Iran. They killed 3,000-4,000 prisoners in the summer of 88. They ended the Iran-Iraq war with accepting the UN resolution and a ceasefire. And then to cover up the killings, they released, Khomeini gave an amnesty, and they released most of the rest of the prisoners at that time. So it was really a propaganda scheme to release the rest of the prisoners and then cover up the mass killing of the most of the prisoners that, as I said, happened in summer of 1988. Mm. So that was the reason they released us. But I was under house arrest in Tehran, and I was not allowed to leave Tehran, basically the capital of Iran. So I managed to get smugglers from Turkey and abroad to help me, and I escaped to, after about half a year after my release, I escaped to illegally to Turkey and then to Germany.
Actually, and you just mentioned the war that was going on with Iraq at that time. So you went into prison, there was no war, you came out, there was a war continuing, and that made a tremendous impression on the society too, didn't it?
Yeah, actually, the war had started, just to correct what you said, the war had started in 1980. So when I went to prison, the war had already started.
Uh-huh.
But Ayatollah Khomeini and his regime exploited the war situation, actually, to solidify his regime and to suppress and oppress all the opposition, even opposition from within his regime. So the war was going on. It was one of the longest wars, as you know. It was 8 years, from 1980 to 1988. So it was there was a lot of shortage. There was a lot of ban of things, events in Iran, shortages of materials and goods, and all the freedom of speech and everything was curtailed because of the war situation. And prisoners basically were kept in prison and were tortured and killed with the reasoning that it's a wartime and we need to keep the country quiet.
Mm.
So that's how they killed and tortured a lot of prisoners in those years. And at the end, when they ended the war, actually, they exploited the ending of the war to kill mass of prisoners and then released the rest and said, we have no more political prisoners, declared that they had no more political prisoners in Iran.
Mm.
It was a very smart scheme, I would say, in those days that Khomeini and his regime resorted to.
So from those days, can you extrapolate what you think is going on there now with the prisoner, these trials that are happening?
Yeah, I should, before I say that, I should say that after the opposition in the 80s were basically organized opposition, political parties, organized groups, and that opposition was completely crushed in the 1980s. By 1990, when we were released from prison, there was no more organized opposition in Iran, and out of regime, out of system, or anti-establishment in Iran. So all of them either had been killed, destroyed, or they were in exile in European countries mostly. The new opposition started really in 1990s with the reformist movement and reformist president, Mohammad Khatami, who was elected in 1997. And he was elected by almost 70% of the vote in Iran. But unfortunately, he could not do much because of the power that ultra-conservatives had in Iran, in the regime. And then things were silent until recently, when the regime needed really the recent openings before the recent election in 2009 to bring people to vote so they can have a legitimacy internationally, so they can claim they had 80% participated in the election, and from those 50-60% voted for Ahmadinejad, the current president. So that's why that opened up the atmosphere and space in the country for the opposition, reformist opposition within the system, and also in reality for the movement, the real movement, which was the outside of the system. It was a movement for democracy and social justice in Iran, containing all NGOs, especially the women's movement, which is the strongest social movement in Iran, and also youth and students, poor. And Iran has one of the youngest countries for populations, as you know. So this real movement, which was separate really from the reformist within regime movement, both happened at the same time because the street movement exploited the situation, the openings, and then they chose really Mir Hossein Mousavi, one of the candidates, to use him to push the ultra-conservatives and to exploit the situation. Mm. And that's how these events came about, and a majority, everyone believes, voted for the reformist opposition candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi. Mm-hmm. But the ultra-conservatives, the Revolutionary Guard, with their all of their financial supports and the money they had distributed in the rural area, basically, by cheating they were able to steal the vote and make Ahmadinejad again the president. But these events caused a backlash, really, and people in the streets revolted, basically, against the system. And that resulted in the clashes and in the arrest, torture, rape, and killing that everyone knows happened in the last couple of months mm-hmm. in Iran.
One of the sayings that I had, I understand, is used in Iran is... there is fire under the ashes, and it looks to me as though when this thing began, the opening began to happen, a lot of people, a lot of passion began to rise to the surface, and this is partly what we were seeing in the streets.
Exactly. So because of the, after the reformist movement of the 1997 and the reformist president, then there was a clash with the students in the dormitories in Tehran University, and they killed a lot of students, the ultra-conservatives and the militia and the thugs. And after that, there was really a quiet period in Iran under Ahmadinejad, even before, at the end of the last president, Mohammad Khatami's era. But underneath, there was a lot of movements, a lot of horizontal organizations. And these are basically the new style, electronic savvy young people organizing themselves. And they were waiting for an opportunity. There was a lot of passion, a lot of anger. And the youth are unemployed. There's a lot of force, really, in Iran that needs to be released, you know, into the society. So they were waiting for an opportune moment, really. And this election and the tactic, the strategy used by the regime itself for gaining a legitimacy internationally and internally, they gave an opportunity to all these passions and all these angers to basically spill out in the streets. And you could see how powerful, how strong the women were in these demonstrations, in these massive rallies. And I know for a fact that women NGOs and youth NGOs and other groups, they were really strong, and human rights groups, they were really strong in Iran. And they are the ones that actually are being crushed and are being arrested and tortured and killed in this whole thing.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it went on for you see all of these people in the street, and then you'd hear about the clampdown, and the next day there would be another huge crowd in the streets. I mean, it was really quite amazing to see the determination.
Yeah, I mean, we should know that in recent events, really, for the first time in the 30-year history of the Islamic Republic, brought out a couple of new things. One was the cracks in the clerical regime. So it was the first time in the 30 years Iranian Islamic Republic history that now grand ayatollahs, major clerics on both sides of the political arena, on the reformist within the regime, on the reformist side and on the conservative side, are standing firmly against each other. This is the first time in the 30 years that this happened. Also, we see in this new event that a new really structure of the regime is coming to surface, and that's the Revolutionary Guards, the military side of the militia, the Revolutionary Guards, which have most of the economic power really in Iran, with the support of the ultra-conservatives, almost Taliban-like ayatollahs, like Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi, who really interprets Islam as very close to the Taliban. They wanna really curtail all kinds of Western notions in Iran, all forms of freedoms, all forms of even government structures, the Majlis or the parliament in Iran, even the presidency. So they are very extreme, but they support the Ahmadinejad regime, and they are supported by the militia, the Revolutionary Guard, and the militia, who control most of the economic power, led by the supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. So this is the faction that really is pushing the so-called reformist faction out of the system, really, in this event. So these are new events, really, that happened. And the street demonstration and the street movement, really, by its presence, as you said, by its passion, its presence, its continuity, has caused these cracks within the regime, and has opened up space, in my opinion, that gives me hope that this movement is deeper than the movement we had in the 80s, which was based on traditional political organizations. Mm-hmm. And this one is a massive movement. I'm hopeful that even though it may calm down and be quiet for a while, but it'll come back in other opportunities and it'll continue.
The fire under the ashes. Yeah, let me remind our listeners that we're talking with Jafar Yagobi about his experiences in Iran in the late 70s and the 80s, and using those experiences to deconstruct what's going on now. This is KZSU Stanford, and I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. Do you think, Jafar, that there was a miscalculation in turning out the vote so hugely for Ahmadinejad and doing it so fast? Do you think that there would have been, it could have been handled in a more subtle way?
Yes. So the plan of the supreme leader, the Revolutionary Guard, and the ultra-conservatives was that they would bring people out in massive numbers for their own legitimacy in their negotiations, basically, with the Obama administration, with the West. So they thought that they would need a legitimate president, Ahmadinejad, with massive numbers of votes behind him so they can go strongly into these negotiations. But they miscalculated in the sense that they had thought by distributing money, which they had done in the rural areas, and by the perceived Ahmadinejad popularity. They had thought that Ahmadinejad was popular in the Arab streets, in the Islamic streets, and in Iran. So they had thought that they would win the election. But, as I explained, the reformist movement within the regime, but more importantly, the democratic movement within the society exploited the situation, and their miscalculation was that the opposition was really winning the election. So at that point, they had to the supreme leader, according to documents that has come out now, the supreme leader ordered the stop of the counting of the votes because they did not want it to go to a runoff election, because if Mir Hossein Mousavi and Ahmadinejad had not won 50%, they would have gone to a second round, a runoff round, and that could have caused serious problems for the regime with the massive move, democratic movement that was growing in the streets. So they decided that they had miscalculated, they had to stop that, and then they rushed into announcing that the election was over and Ahmadinejad had won, which was a forced miscalculation this time. They had not done it if they had planned correctly, but they had no choice. They went into that, and that brought the following the street demonstrations and the basically uprisings. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, here in the United States, we had President Obama for a while refusing to make any comment and getting a lot of flack from the conservatives here. McCain, for example, was saying he had to, do something. What do you think of the way Obama handled the publicity around that in this country?
Well, I think initially Obama and his administration was also caught off guard, really. They did not know how to react to it. And initially, even they did not very strongly support the democratic movement and peaceful demonstration that people were doing in the initial days after the election. But on the other hand, the conservatives like McCain and others, they were forcing that the U.S. should respond strongly, even with boycotts and everything, and bans and everything on Iranian contacts and stuff. But I think gradually Obama administration came to and Hillary Clinton came to the conclusion that they could not continue what they were doing. So a few days after the election and the start of the suppression and killing and tortures, they started correcting their positions and their line, and they supported the at least they supported the peaceful demonstration and gathering of the people. But in general, the policy that Obama is pursuing is to negotiate with whoever is in charge of the regime in Iran, which is the supreme leader. As you know, president really does not have the final authority in Iran by constitution. The supreme leader does on most important issues, peace, war, security reasons, and financial, and most issues in Iran, and judiciary, and everything. So Obama administration has concluded that they would have to negotiate with the supreme leader and whoever he thinks is the president in Iran, which is Ahmadinejad. So I think they are going to negotiate with Iran after things settle down. And I don't agree with the extremist view in the neoconservatives and later other conservatives in the U.S. administration pursuing, and the Israel lobby, which are pursuing a military solution to Iran. I don't agree with that. I don't think there is a military solution to Iranian question. Although I don't know, I was a political prisoner, tortured in Iranian prisons, but I don't agree, and I'm opposed to the regime. But I don't agree that there is a military solution to this issue. I think negotiated solution on the nuclear issue and other issues and the security issue that Iran has, concerns that Iranian regime has regarding Israel and U.S. Potential military attacks, I think the negotiation solution would be the best solution for Iran, for the region, for U.S., under current circumstances.
Although at the same time, we've done a number of shows on the region. In fact, last week we did one on Armenia, and the reality is that there's a lot of natural resources there that the United States covets, oil, natural gas, and so forth. How does this come into how the United States might negotiate with Iran in the future?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the Bush policy of the the 2000s, the first 7-8 years of the 2000s, after 9/11, the Iraq war and the Iraq fiasco and things that happened afterwards, even in Afghanistan, the situation in Afghanistan, all of these, the Bush policy really played into the hands of the ultra-conservatives in Iran, and they were able to strengthen their power, not only within Iran by crushing the opposition, but also within the region, within Iraq and within Afghanistan. So as a lot of people have said in the United States and all over the world, the Islamic regime was the real winner of the situation in Iraq, mostly in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. So in that sense, unless you bring Iran, by negotiating with Iran, you bring Iran and you bring peace to the region, the resources that are in the region, which are in Iraq, in Iran, in the Persian Gulf area, even in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and other countries there, these energy resources, which is the largest in the world, gas and oil, those could be in danger. So that's another reason that although the reason going to Iraq by the Bush administration was basically for the oil and gas, in my opinion, and for the strategic reasons in the region, but for Obama to secure a peaceful solution to that region, negotiations with Iran, which has a strong role, it's a powerful country in the region, would be a wise strategy to go. And all of these actually relate to the more strategic global questions that one could ponder about, like the China and India phenomena and their need for energy resources that is growing daily and coming up in the next decade or so, and then the control that Russian Republic has on the European gas and oil needs. So all of these really complicate the situation in the Middle East. And of course you have the Palestinian-Israeli issue, which is always in there. So all of these complicates the situation, and Iran has had and has a central role in that region, and that's why the Obama administration, rightly I think, is, and Hillary Clinton believes that they should go with Iran with a negotiation if they can. If they couldn't, then they can use other means, but they should pursue that to the end to see if they can resolve the situation for U.S. national interest and strategic interest by resolving these problems with Iran peacefully.
And yet at the same time, we hear what I would call relatively bellicose rhetoric from Hillary. You know, Iran must do this. Iran must stop their nuclear program. Isn't there a way that would allow Americans to understand the region in a more sophisticated manner if we approached it in a way, okay, we're going to negotiate on these grounds, and the grounds are going to be not force, they're going to be negotiation, you know, a way that would allow more understanding of the cultures and the history, and in a way that was more productive.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, the arrogance of empires historically has caused this one-sided approach to the other societies and other countries over the history, and this one is no exception. But I should also give credit to President Obama and to Hillary Clinton in the sense that they have changed. President Obama basically have changed the tone of the approach to Iran in the sense that he said we will negotiate on a mutual understanding and on a mutual equal status. And that's the first time that has been said, because previously, until the end of Bush administration, U.S. policy had been that Iran had to, it was the negotiations would have been conditional. Iran had to stop their nuclear purification and had to stop the, supporting the so-called terrorist groups in Palestinian groups and stuff, and then the negotiations would happen. And Islamic Republic had always rejected those preconditions. Obama, for the first time, basically put the game in a plain, plain level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a good thing to do, because that, and also he's a little more sensitive to the cultural issues of other countries, which helps a lot, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, just his Ramadan, the start of Ramadan, he made that statement. We've never seen that in the United States before. We've never heard that in the United States before.
To the Islamic world in general, at large, and to Iran in particular. And I think those sensitivities to people, other people's cultures, languages, beliefs, religious beliefs, those would help ease the walls that have been built over the maybe centuries and or decades between different cultures, particularly say between Iran and U.S. As you know, are only in Iranian history the only prime minister elected by a real democratic election ever in Iran in 1950s was overthrown by a coup d'etat of CIA and MI5, MI6 in British intelligence services in 1953.
Which is something also that has only recently become more common knowledge in the general American public. For a long time, it was just not discussed or never admitted. And Obama actually mentioned that in his Cairo speech.
Oh, yeah. It was only 7-8 years, if I remember correctly, 7-8 years ago, that the CIA documents came into the public arena. They were published, some parts of it, but it was President Clinton's she was the first time that apologized for
Albright.
Albright apologized for the 1953 coup. So it was in the Clinton times, but afterwards, again, it was forgotten. It wasn't really that much publicized in the U.S. until the Obama administration started admitting and publicizing it. But I'm saying there are a lot of grievances that the Iranian society and other societies have towards U.S. foreign policy. Even Afghanis have the same problem. Iraqis have the same problem. Palestinians have the same. A lot of other countries have the same problems. And it would be really helpful for us in this country if our government is sensitive to other people's cultures and admits wrongdoings. And that would help open dialogue and open relationships and open negotiations when problems come up, and then you can resolve it really honestly and on a peaceful with a peaceful means.
Yeah, Jafar. Recently in San Francisco, there was a huge rally. About 5,000 to 7,000 people showed up. Most of them were Iranian, in support of what was going on, in support of the people of Iran. And I'm wondering, is there anything that you would suggest for our listeners to do that can continue to support the people of Iran? It seems to be dropping off the newspaper, the front pages of the mainstream news at this point.
Yeah, I should say that Iranians abroad in general, Iranian Americans in this country, they were really active in supporting the opposition in Iran, supporting the movement in Iran, the movement for democracy in Iran. And they helped a lot by exposing the brutality, the torture, the rapes in Iran and killing and beatings in the streets, and by pressuring United Nations, by pressuring the U.S. government, by pressuring their congressmen, their senators. So people can do, can expose the Iranian regime violence against peaceful demonstrators, their continued oppression and suppression of even the reform movement. And this is the reform movement within regime that I'm talking about, people like Mousavi, Khatami, and Karoubi, who were candidate, who some of them were president and Speaker of Congress, one was prime minister of the system. So these are people who are reformists within the system. But even those are being pressured by the ultra-conservatives, their parties are being closed, their newspapers are being shut down. So I think Americans in general and Iranian Americans should continue their demonstrations, their gatherings, and collecting signatures, collecting money, even financial aid, so they can support NGOs, they can support groups that are fighting in Iran, and also they should put pressure on UN and on U.S. government to basically, with peaceful means, to support the opposition in Iran and to put pressure on the Iranian regime in general and on ultra-conservatives in particular in their negotiations that I'm sure they are doing behind the scenes and they will do openly in the future, Western Europe and U.S. in particular, in my opinion.
Do you have a news outlet that you particularly think is good that people can go to?
Well, you mean in English?
Yeah.
Yeah, in England, there are actually a lot of Iranian electronic newspapers that they have their English pages. There is one called Guya News. Guya is spelled G-O-O-Y-A. Guya News. And there is one called Iran Emruz. Emruz means today. Iran Emruz. Iran E-M-R-O-O-Z.
Okay, and those are online newspapers?
Yeah, these are all online.
Okay.
You just search for these words, you'll see those sites, and then they have English. But there's also official Iranian newspapers from within Iran that are online. So anybody interested, and they have their English pages, so anybody interested in the official version of what's going on in Iran, they can also look at those online. If they search for Iranian newspapers, they will find those too.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. This has been a great overview. Before we go, I want to give you a last shot at letting our listeners know something that you think is really important and that you may not have covered.
Well, I think we covered, at least in the limited time we had, we covered most of the stuff, current stuff and important stuff. But the only thing I want to emphasize is that the notion that women in Iran are portrayed as these coward, Muslim, weak people, oppressed people sitting home, that's absolutely a misconceptual notion. Iranian women are the strongest force in Iran, as you've seen in the recent events. And Westerners should read more about Iranian women movements, and they should support them.
Well, perhaps in the future you can help us find some good women, Iranian women, to have on the show. That
Absolutely.
Would be great.
Absolutely. That would be my pleasure.
Yeah.
I would do that.
We'll look forward to it. Well, thank you for being with us. This has been great.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Jafar Yagoubi, who is finishing up a political prison memoir titled Purge of Dissent, Mass Killing of Political Prisoners in Iran. Another book, I'm going to promote my own book here, Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror. You can find this book on my website, which is mothersspeakaboutwarandterror.org or motherspeak.org. Better yet, you can host a book party and I will come on down to your place, your office or your home, share the stories of the book and talk about the book. find ways to have you plug into more progressive movements and learn more about the people in the book. If you're interested in hosting a book party, get in touch with me through this website. That's susan@raisingsandradio.org. You're always encouraged, as usual, to contact me and suggest shows for suggest topics for shows you'd like to hear, or just to make comments on the shows that we do have. Again, that's susan@raisingsandradio.org. And that's our show for this week. As usual, views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. We'll go out today with Sufi music by Hassan Kasai called Duskar Amhayun, from the album Classical Music of Iran.